This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we're going to be talking about getting your views about what you think the goals of our national space program should be, or even if you should have a space program. So to start off the hour, let's get an update on where the investigation is headed. Investigators, as you know, are combing the ground over several states in hopes of finding a key piece of debris from the space shuttle Columbia that might be a clue into the cause of the breakup. Joining me now for an update on the investigation is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. He joins us from our studios in Washington. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Ira.
Any important pieces of debris found so far?
Yes, the most important debris that has been found is the a wing that was found today someplace near Fort Worth, Texas. And that's quite an amazing thing because they don't know if it's a left wing or the right wing yet, but the wing is going to tell them a lot. They already know that there are problems with the shuttle that started. The first indications of trouble they had were from the left wing. So this wing is a piece of major interest to NASA.
Is it the whole wing or just a piece of a wing?
It's been being described as a large piece of the wing. It's we know that it has the front edge, which is a super hard carbon material that's supposed to be able to withstand the big heat of reentry. It also has a number of tiles on it, so it's a big clue.
So where do we stand now? How can you give us a bit of a nutshell, a summary of where we stand in this investigation?
Well, we are actually moving along fairly well, considering how much of a mystery it is. NASA, of course, immediately got the data that was beamed down from the space shuttle at the time of the last few minutes of the flight, and that has provided some very interesting information about what was happening when on the orbiter. They know that some of the materials, something strange was happening in the left wing. It was heating up. They were losing some sensors, which presumably means some wires were breaking there. So they have that. They also have a great deal of video, both amateur video and a little bit of professional video. And we're also learning they also have some military video as well. In particular, Aviation Week and Space Report, which is a major trade magazine, reported today that the Air Force has a telescope they don't really talk about very much, but it's in New Mexico. And they were taking pictures of the shuttle as it came in on that. And according to Aviation Week, those pictures showed that the left wing of the shuttle had a jagged edge, was shredding up a little bit. So that, if confirmed, would be another very important clue about what happened.
The fact that it's in New Mexico, that pushes the timeline back a little bit, doesn't it? Making it an important
Well,
piece.
It does. I think the first signs of trouble were when the shuttle was over California's coast. And so the events that gradually unfolded over the next 5 or 6 minutes as it made its way over Texas are critical. So New Mexico's right in the middle of that, actually within about a minute, I guess, of the shuttle actually breaking up. So that could prove to be a critical moment in the shuttle.
Of course, we heard about this piece of foam hitting the shuttle. It was a candidate. It was out. Now it's back in because they don't want to rule out anything. But we also heard.
Indeed, I think this is more of a case of the media overinterpreting and maybe underinterpreting what the engineers were saying with maybe a little bit too much care and precision as opposed to being very direct about it. But one thing that was noticed about 80 seconds after liftoff was a large piece of foam broke off a strut that connects the space shuttle to the external fuel tank. And it's weighed about 2 or 3 pounds, something like that, it's estimated. And it did strike the shuttle. There's a little bit of video of this hitting the underside of the shuttle and bursting into a million pieces, it so appears. NASA looked very carefully at that at the time. While the shuttle was in orbit, this is apparently not that extraordinarily unusual for the shuttle to have something like this happen. And as they analyzed that, they decided it was not a big issue because it's really light foam. It shouldn't damage the tile seriously. So NASA said, we don't think that's a really big problem. However, since it was the only clue people had early on, a lot of people glommed onto that as a distinct possibility. And NASA has not discounted it absolutely. But on the other hand, everything that they have, all of their engineering efforts, suggests that that should not have done enough to create the kind of devastating damage we saw on Saturday.
And so they were sort of forced to look into other theories, and so even some theories that, you know, are on the fringe of possibility. Like, weren't they looking into the possibility that a meteorite or some space junk collided with the wings?
Yeah, and that's actually not as strange as it might seem. The shuttle actually has a substantial risk from hitting stuff in space, not so much meteorites, but man-made junk, which is just filling that area of low Earth orbit.
There are tens of thousands
shuttle
of pieces.
Sort of has to dodge the big pieces, which can be seen from the ground, but little pieces are just invisible, and the risk of hitting those is substantial. It's, 1 in 200, 1 in 300, 1 in 400, depending upon the flight, and and we're not just talking about running into something and having it maybe do some damage. Those statistics are enough damage to actually destroy the orbiter. So that's not a crazy theory. Mm. It's a very difficult one to demonstrate, but it's not crazy.
Yeah. And there are tens of thousands of pieces flying around there, left over from past missions of all kinds going back 40 years. Let's talk about the investigation. The investigation has been known, and you've talked about this in your reporting, it's been unusually open. They're trying to open it up even more and make it seem as squeaky clean as they can by the people they're putting on these committees and by the fact that they're going to be taking, did I read today, that they're going to be actually taking it out of NASA's control so that NASA can't be accused of having too much influence?
Yeah, this is all part of a plan that flowed out of the Rogers Commission report after the Space Shuttle Challenger. As you recall, when Challenger blew up in 1986, the president appointed a commission that was chaired by Mr. Rogers, who basically said, okay, here's what NASA has to do differently. And one thing NASA had done wrong during the Challenger investigation was it was very secretive. It knew very early on, or had a very good idea early on, about what went wrong with Challenger, and it just sat on that information and didn't tell the public, and it created a lot of suspicion and distrust of the space agency. So this time around, NASA had a plan in place ready to go for another catastrophe, and that included having an independent board to step in and actually do the analysis. NASA is gathering the information, but then it's handing it over to this independent board to do the analysis. And some members of Congress yesterday said, hey, this independent board may not be as independent as we would like. It contains largely other government officials from the military and the Department of Transportation and other places like that. So the independent board is going to add a few members of folks from really outside of government to give the real sense that it is truly independent.
You can hopefully find another Richard Feynman type being sitting.
Oh, that would be lovely.
Do you think maybe by this evening we'll know about that wing? Do they have the wing in hand, and so to speak? I mean, will they tell us, do you think, pretty soon?
Well, they certainly have it in hand, and all of the parts of the space shuttle are stamped with parts numbers, so anyone who's actually seen that and has the parts list can tell us if it's the right wing or the left wing. So I'm sure somebody in the field already knows. The question is whether that information will flow back quickly enough to the Johnson Space Center in Houston, where the briefings come from, and we'll just have to wait and see.
All right, well, we'll be tuned into All Things Considered this evening and find out. Thank you, Richard.
My pleasure, Ira.
Richard Harris is NPR science correspondent reporting for us from Washington. The shuttle disaster is making a lot of people think about our space program and rethink about where we have come from, where we are, and where we want to go. And some people have called for a national debate on the future of manned space flight. And why not? Seems like a good time to do that. And so for the rest of the hour, we'll be taking your thoughts on the direction of the space program. Should we be focusing so much time and money and attention on the shuttle fleet? Should it be scrapped? Should it be upgraded? What do you think? What would you do differently? And what about the International Space Station? What should we do with that? Should the government be in the space flight business anymore? I mean, if you think about it, it's been 40 years since we got into space, 40 years after the Wright brothers, and this is the 100th anniversary this year of the Wright brothers, 40 years later, we had all kinds of airliners and airplanes and things like that. The government was not really in the airline business. We're now 40 years after our first satellites and people in space. Why don't we have private industry involved in space? Maybe they should be taking over where the government leaves off. What do you think? What should we be doing more of? How about maybe we should be sending out more probes to the planets? Should we be sending people? Should we be sending these robots that are much cheaper to send than people, but can they do as good a job as people can do? Should we be building a base on the moon or on Mars or expanding all kinds of different things? You make the call. You decide. Tell us what you think. And consider this while you're deciding, that China has announced plans to put its first man into space, perhaps as soon as October. Can you say Taikonaut, which is the Chinese version? The Chinese space program is on the rise. Will it eclipse a faltering U.S. space program? You know, you don't need any new technology to get to the moon. We invented it. You already paid for it, and it's been sitting on the shelf for decades for anyone, including the Chinese, perhaps the Indian government. The Indians are involved in space, to come along and pick up the gauntlet. So what do you think? Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you want more information about what we're talking about this hour, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Joining me to talk about space exploration and space politics is Louis Friedman. He's executive director of the Planetary Society, that is a pro-space exploration group based in Pasadena, California. He joins us from our member station KPCC in Pasadena. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
You're welcome. Eligar Sadeh is an assistant professor in space studies, Department of Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences. That's at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks, North Dakota. He's also editor of the Space Politics, a book called Space Politics and Policy, an Evolutionary Perspective, published by Kluwer. He joins us by phone from a conference on space colonization. Welcome to the program, Mr. Sadeh.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Louis. What is your take on where, following this disaster, the space program lies now?
Well, it's your call for a debate and the future of human spaceflight, I think, is well timed. I think we need to have that. I think we have also shown that the country, and indeed the world, cares about space exploration. They care about humans in space, and humans in space are the basis of popular interest, and this should not surprise us. The whole idea and the psyche of space exploration is to be exploring the unknown and to respond to the basic human desire to look outward and gain knowledge and make achievements beyond the current limits. So, I'm absolutely convinced from what I've heard in the last week, as well as everything I've worked for in the last 40 years, mm-hmm. that space exploration is a vital part of popular and public interest, and it will continue. Having said that, are humans, should they be doing other things in space, the mundane activities in space? Should they be carrying cargo vehicles up to space? Should they be doing teaching in space? Should they be doing writing? Should they be doing science experiments? There's many mundane activities that the shuttle has been used for that are unrelated to the basic idea of exploring the unknown and making greater achievements. And I think that focus, the focus of humans only doing the things in space that are particularly human, particularly require humans, and only doing the things that are really worth the risk. The potential gain from human flight must be worth the risk. And I think that ought to be our mantra. That ought to be our guiding principle in reconstructing the human spaceflight program. Mm. And I think it'll be a great program because I think that's what the public cares about as we look out and try for greater achievements in exploration and mm-hmm. discovery.
Eligar Sadeh, I've got about a minute before the break.
Yeah.
How badly does the loss of Columbia hurt our space effort, and where should it go from here?
Well, I think it's obviously very tragic, but I think we must remember these astronauts were pioneers and were trying to advance the whole human endeavor in space. And I think ultimately the longer-term goal is to actually settle and also live in space, actually colonize space and develop bases on the moon and Mars. And I think these astronauts were pioneers in that endeavor. And overall, I think the immediate response will be to clearly investigate what took place to correct those problems. You know, NASA's way of doing business is to imagine everything that could possibly go wrong, and to try to fix those problems. And as a whole, I think we'll remedy the problems. We'll continue flying shuttle and space station, which is essential to understanding how humans need to live in. Understanding the whole human physiology in space. And that becomes the basis for humans living and working mm-hmm. in space and colonizing the solar system in the future.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and take your phone calls because we want to hear what you think where the space policy should go and what direction, if any. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. We're talking this hour about your priorities for the space program. My guests are Louis Friedman, Executive Director of the Planetary Society, Eligar Sadeh, he's Assistant Professor in Space Studies, Department of Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Cliff in Taos, New Mexico. Hi, Cliff.
Hi.
Hi there.
Well, I have real concerns about the future of the effort in space. I really want to see that it's not dominated by U.S. military concerns, that it's open to the other nations. And these concerns are highlighted by, I've perused the website of the U.S. Space Command, and it's all about claiming the high ground and dominating space and denying access to space. And it's a very scary prospect. We've seen the NASA rely more and more on the military to fund the space shuttle operations. And we know that the U.S. Space, the military space plane is perhaps the next generation. And underneath this somewhat, this seemingly civilian program, I think, is lurking, in fact, some very explicit interests in domination and militarization.
Let me get a Dr. Sadat, well, how do you react to that?
Well, I think those concerns are essentially well taken, but we have to understand that, that space has a, you know, space has a number of sectors. There's the military sector, clearly, but there's also the civil sector where we do space science, humans in space. There's also the commercial sector, and we do have a commercial space program. There's commercial entities involved in space, so many of our endeavors are actually very peaceful. In fact, international law has a basis of looking at space in terms of peaceful uses. Many of our military activities are also passive. They essentially deal with navigation, communication, remote sensing, which are essential to our national security interests and also protecting our economic assets in space, such as telecommunication satellites, etc. So I think there's an important synergy to play between the military and also the civil and commercial programs. But clearly there is some concern about this whole debate now regarding weaponization of space and the military need to control the high ground. That clearly, you know, that clearly is something that needs to be discussed openly, as, you know, as I think the military is doing so far.
But space has been militarily occupied for 40 years, hasn't it? I mean,
yeah,
space started out as a place that would launch ICBMs and things like that.
Yes, I mean, space has been militarized from the beginning, but we have to remember that the military systems in space are essentially passive systems. They're to look back towards Earth, to communicate, to navigate, weather monitoring, and also remote sensing, reconnaissance, which is very fundamental towards our military operations worldwide. So that stays within the framework of peaceful uses of space, which was enshrined in the Outer Space Law of 1967.
Hmm. Dr. Friedman?
Yeah, I think it's important to keep the distinction. The military space question, which is a big one, as your caller identified, is a military question. It's not a space question. Many of the things we're talking about in space are quite separate. And, in fact, the military has almost no interest in the shuttle, puts almost no money into it. And the same for the space station. Sometimes that's a quite a misunderstanding. And, in fact, space station, now we're going to have to rely on the Russians. And the Russians are a much more major part of our space station program than is any United States military activity. And it's a good thing we have the Russians involved because we may need them for the access to and from the station and supply for it for the next several months. So international cooperation is very important, and we're glad we have it now in the civil space program. And I agree, I guess, with your caller that says we're going to need it more. But I think he needs to separate out and not worry and, you know, treat the military space issue as a military issue and not get it into the NASA programs.
It seems that one of the ways that NASA has sold the space shuttle and the space station to the public as a means for commercialization and for finding new medical products, things like that. Do you think it was oversold that way, and we should have just gone to the public and say, we're going out to space because it's a final frontier and we want to explore things?
Absolutely it was oversold for that reason. And that's gotten us into some of this trouble. We were hoisted on our own petard back in the 80s and prior to Challenger with a whole lot of talk about routine access to space and developing space for tourists. And we're going to have civilians fly to space. We had politicians and journalists and teachers. And then, of course, Challenger brought us back to reality in a quick hurry. And I'm afraid we're at that same situation again now. This is not worth the loss of life. These things are better done on Earth. These are not activities that, and almost everything that's true of this particular shuttle, actually. We need to be honest with the purposes of the space program and say these humans are only going to do something that is really worth the risk, and that is going to other worlds, exploring frontiers, seeking the new knowledge and discovery that really advances humankind as a civilization.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Nathan in Mesa, Arizona. Hi, Nathan. Nathan, are you there?
I am.
Hi, go ahead.
I'm calling because I think that we really need to go out and we need to end up colonizing space. And because of that, I actually think that using the military and commercial applications to actually build bases in space, especially on the moon, would probably be the best way. I think the government has the resources to put the first foot out there that the rest of us can follow. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, thank you for calling. Dr. Sadeh, you're at a conference for colonizing space. How are they seeing the progression happening here?
Well, they clearly see it in these specific terms, as our caller indicated. The whole idea is that, you know, our next grand enterprise should be, you know, the human colonization of space, establishment of essentially bases on the moon and Mars. And we can clearly look at the shuttle program and space station program as enabling technologies to essentially allow us to do this. Maybe it's not the most practical way to do it, but we have a lot of sunk costs into these programs. I think people clearly lose sight that both shuttle and station are geared towards doing science. You know, if we can remedy the problems in terms of the crew on the space station program, there are a tremendous amount of scientific investigations we do that really have a lot of benefits here back home in modeling diseases, remote sensing, microgravity materials processing, et cetera. Plus, the fundamental issues that we need to understand how humans can live and function in space, and that is essential. If we are going to go forward with this grand enterprise into the future of colonizing space, we must first learn how to live there on a long-term basis. And station and shuttle both play a fundamental role in that particular endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Professor Friedman, the president submitted his budget, his 2004 budget proposal for NASA. Anything of interest in there that you teased out of it that looks very hopeful for you?
Yeah, it's a remarkable commitment to the future of space exploration. We need to compliment NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe, who a year ago came in talking about budgets and fixing the paperwork at NASA, and within a year has sort of adopted the view, which we've shared all along, which is that exploration and science is what NASA is primarily about. And in the submitted budget is a commitment to deep space exploration with the introduction of a nuclear propulsion and nuclear power initiative for a mission to Jupiter and its icy moons, Europa and Ganymede in particular, which may be have underground oceans that could be important in the detection of extraterrestrial life. He's introduced a optical communication capability for use on the 2009 Mars orbiter. This is really important if we're going to choose landing sites on Mars with from observations around Mars, if we're going to bring lots of data back to Mars so that we can all have 3D holograms and do virtual reality exploration of Mars.
This is like streaming video coming back from Mars.
Well, I think that's going to come. I mean, it's quite exciting that he's committed to that. He's committed to the deep space exploration. And something else he's committed to, which is really amazing, is he put the human research program back into the space station that was taken out in the previous times because of cost cutting. He announced the goal of getting humans to work on space flights that are longer than 100 days. Mm-hmm. And the only reason you have space flight for more than 100 days is to do interplanetary missions beyond low Earth orbit. So I think it's a major step forward in a commitment to the long-range goal of sending humans beyond low Earth orbit.
And yet the budget is still minuscule, the total budget, and the actual increase was $500 million, which, if you look at the cost of military hardware, is equal to about 2.5 fighter planes that they're F-20.
That's right. It was only a 3% increase on a budget, which is about a half a day of DOD spending in total. So it really is quite a small part of our overall national spending. This is something that I think also is different in the public perception. But the space program is really a minor part of the budget, which is why it wouldn't have been mentioned in any of the news articles if it wasn't for this tragic accident last Saturday. Mm.
And before we go to the calls, also, when he was on our program a few months ago, he did talk about this idea that they have to find a faster way of getting around the cosmos here. And he did talk about a nuclear-powered engine, which would, I think, it was described to me on a flight to Mars, it would cut the time down from 6 months to like 4 weeks, which is an incredibly fast.
I think that statement may be not quite correct, at least in my experience of having looked at these things. I don't think you can get a four-week practical trip time to Mars.
I don't think. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones again. Let's go to Kyle in Boston. Hi, Kyle.
Yeah, hi. Is this Ira?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for taking my call. I sure would think we should have to go vigorously, you know, for colonization because of these imminent threats we're facing with volcano, super volcano outbreaks. We have asteroids, comets, you know, that might jeopardize us. And I think one thing I always miss in this discussion is the link between, you know, military or peace and these kinds of dangers. I think we can pursue those things maybe only if we really have everlasting world peace here on Earth. And I wish, you know, there would be some more push from the scientists and the politicians in this direction. Mm-hmm. That's my comment.
Thanks for calling. Dr. Sadeh, what about colonization of the moon? It would seem like a logical next step, you know, in the 70s. Whatever happened to it?
Well, it clearly was a logical next step. You know, what essentially happened, we have to remember that Apollo was essentially about politics. It was about, you know, putting a flag and footprints on the moon. It was about the Cold War superpower struggle and proving that the U.S. was better than the Russian system, the former Soviet system. So that program ended. The political support for it ended. You know, we have to understand, you know, Carl Sagan, who in fact was the founder of the Planetary Society, Lou Friedman directs, you know, a statement in one of his books, Pale Blue Dot, made the point that, you know, exploring space needs to make real political sense. You know, and with this whole agenda today, you know, we have a chance. We have a focusing event that took place here. We have, you know, this tragic event, Columbia, and it's seen as a focusing event within the political system. So we start engaging about what should be the future of our space program. You know, I think as a whole, we shouldn't pitch this as an either-or proposition. You know, very often we say it should be about humans or robotics or about governmental programs or commercial programs or military programs. I think these different sectors, the human robotics sectors, can work together in harmony. I think there can be synergies that are possible to create to essentially advance these causes. You know, at this conference, as I was at, we were looking at a number of different rationales for lunar-based development, and these rationales involve benefits to humanity, inspiring the imagination, commercial benefits. There's possibly even national security benefits. So going to the moon is really a grand enterprise that cross-cuts all these sectors. Plus, it's an enterprise that can instill international cooperation. You know, that's the mainstay of our space program today. Our human spaceflight program is based on cooperation. And as you mentioned at the onset, there's a number of spacefaring nations that are very interested in, from China to India. We also have to add the European Space Agency. And I think there's very fertile ground for utilizing this next grand enterprise of lunar-based development in terms of fostering cooperation among these different sectors, from the security to the commercial to the civil government-to-government sector. Mm.
Talking about the future of space exploration this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. My guest, Louis Friedman, Executive Director of the Planetary Society, and Eligard Sadeh, who is Assistant Professor in the Space Studies Department of Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Do you think that if we watch China put a man in orbit in October or something like that, that might spur things on here? You know, somebody catching up on the ascension? We're on the decline?
Well, I very much think so. I think, you know, that could stir some degree of competition. But I think once the Chinese, in fact, I think the world climate has changed. You know, we are trying to cooperate with the Chinese, especially if you look at the economic sector, missile proliferation issues, human rights issues. It's in our interest to cooperate with that emerging world power, not just space power. And I think once the Chinese prove that they can put humans in orbit, and they're planning to demonstrate that this year, I think then the Chinese will, in fact, be invited to become members in the International Space Station program. And we will, in fact, preempt competition through cooperation with the Chinese.
Mm-hmm. Louis Friedman, what do you think about the costs? How do you overcome the costs of how expensive it is to put people in space?
Well, take a little issue with the notion that America is in decline. We've had an accident in our space program, and clearly that's a setback. But
well, in a budget of the last 10 years, it's been cut back 40%, hasn't it?
Well, certainly the budget hasn't risen in the last 10 years, but we've had some great accomplishments in the last 10 years, and we've put our space program with a sense of vitality back together with achievements in the Hubble Space Telescope. The Mars program that was initiated had great successes and great failures. We have two wonderful orbiters around Mars now that are beginning to hint at possibilities of water near to the surface and very important in the study of extraterrestrial life. We have five missions going to Mars this year, two from the United States, two from Europe, one from Japan. I think there's a vitality in space exploration, not to mention, of course, the space station and the things I mentioned at the a few minutes ago about what's been proposed in the new budget. So I think there's a vitality in space exploration. What's needed, and I agree with Dr. Sade, what's needed is to bring the human and robotic programs together in that common goal of exploration outward. That's the part that's been missing all along. The robotic man program and the human man, the robotic Mars program, I mean, and the human Mars program need to be brought together in a common goal, and we ought to be doing things in the robotic program that lead directly to human flight. We ought to be doing things in the human program that can enhance some of the performance of these robotic missions. But having said that, I do think that there'll be a determination out of this this whole accident and the discussions that follow to make it play together a little better. And that's what happened after Challenger and the program in the early 90s, reinvigoration of a space program which had really gone awry in the early 80s, was good for the country, good for the world, and I believe that will happen again.
Do you agree, Dr. Sade?
Yeah, I'm very much in agreement. I think, you know, we need to pursue this human-robotic collaboration. In fact, I think beginning in the decade of the 90s, we began to see this closer synergy. And, you know, in fact, NASA's current aggressive Mars exploration program, which Lou Friedman referred to, in fact, we're seeing their test bedding of some enabling technologies that could allow future human missions to Mars. Clearly, the surveying missions, remote sensing missions, the rover missions are also evaluating the environment. You know, there's been reports coming out saying, you know, what's needed to be done on a robotic site to allow humans to go there into the future, because we need to fully assess the risks. We have to understand, you know, NASA is a very careful organization. They want to look at all the risks before they undertake any type of very, you know, high-risk grand adventure like sending humans to Mars. So,
right. I've got to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more about this. So don't go away. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about space exploration and space policy. My guest, Louis Friedman, Executive Director of the Planetary Society. Eligar Sadeh, Assistant Professor in the Space Studies Department of Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones, because lots of people want to talk about this. Of course, you can imagine. Let's go to Matt in Endwell, New York. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how you doing?
Where's Endwell?
Endwell is near Binghamton, New York, right on the border.
Gotcha.
I two things quickly, really. You know, the budget that we spend at NASA, I think, is just, you know, for the size of our nation, is just ridiculous. It's way low. I think we should be doing more in space, and, you know, we get a return on that investment. I mean, all the technology that we've gotten from that. You know, it's a shame how little we actually spend on the space program.
If you only had a certain finite amount of money, would you move it around to, you know, favor one part of the NASA budget over another?
Well, I agree with what was said just a little bit ago. We have to use both of those tools, the manned and the unmanned, together in unison. Everything has to work together, because there are certain things that we just can't do physically, you know, because of our limitations.
Mm-hmm. All right, Matt, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. I found it interesting, Dr. Friedman, that you were talking about almost flipping around the way our space program is working now. Right now, you say, you know, we have, and you point out correctly, we have people in space near orbit going on a shuttle, the space station, and we have robots going to places like Mars. I hear you saying, you know, we should save the risky stuff to go to Mars, put people on Mars, and put the robots to do the mundane stuff in orbit here.
Well, that's an interesting, I actually haven't looked at my own comment that way. It's a good point. I hadn't quite thought of it like that. You know, we shouldn't get too hung up on this humans versus robots aspect. The human missions have a lot of machines, a lot of robotics, including the shuttle flying its way down. There was essentially a robotic activity. And, of course, the robotic missions have a lot of humans working on them. So we shouldn't get too hung up on that, except that I again repeat this call for the integrated whole. I know the Planetary Society is promoting a concept called the Mars Outpost, which would be developed robotically but lead to human flight to that end. Mm-hmm. The essential thing is, I think, that we do have to do something different in regards to Earth orbit, and this is call for a major difference. I think there's been far too much attention and far too much push in the government program to, again, what I call the mundane activities of Earth orbit. And we get victims of our own hype and selling in this regard. And some of the emphasis on calls for space tourism and having the government put in money to develop capabilities for humans to do things in space, which either could be done better on the ground or be done better robotically, is, I think, the change that's going to have to be made. And that's going to be a tough one, because there's a lot of vested interests and a part of space interest people who don't want that to happen.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Sadeh, how come we haven't seen a comparable pace in the commercialization of space and space vehicles and the use of space by companies, in the same way we saw that happening after the Wright brothers, 40 years later?
Well, primarily it's been an issue of market demand. The only real space commerce that currently exists is in the area of telecommunications. And then, of course, the expendable launch vehicles needed to support the launching of those satellites. Everything else, you know, really can't exist on its own. For instance, the remote sensing industry just doesn't have the markets out there. We're still trying to figure out how to make use of space as a platform for economic benefit, and that's been a big problem. And there aren't really any clear answers to that.
Mm-hmm. And there's another key point which we had graphically brought home to us last Saturday, because we were involved in a commercial venture having a private mission to do a solar sail, which the Planetary Society is undertaking. And we keep running into the risk issue. I know of a leader in industry who called up one of our sponsors and said, forget that space stuff. It's too risky. They don't want to get into it because there is going to be a chance for failure. We saw a lot of people who thought they were going to make money in the after Mars Pathfinder with the next Mars mission, and they were going to do all kinds of commercial activities related to the Mars missions. And, of course, those two Mars missions failed, and they've disappeared. Space is risky, and we're going to have to live with that for a long time. It accentuates the need for the government role to focus on those aspects of it which demand the greater interest of societal funding.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Mark in South St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Mark.
Hi. A little bit of 4 point. First, about the shuttle accident. Admittedly, a lot of people thought it was a terrorist, but honestly, I was thinking something like the micrometeorite or something like a space junk we dumped. I remember back in the 80s when they fixed that satellite, they lost a couple of screws. So most of it is they could have caused the accident themselves. And why go into space? Why do anything in some regards? What's to inspire us to go further with anything?
Well, you know, that's interesting, because you heard the president this week in memorializing the astronauts talking about exploration and whatever. But we never hear that as a reason to go into space or to justify spending the money. We always hear there has to be a cost-benefit analysis on the products or whatever we're going to reap out of space.
Well, in some regards, Kennedy sort of pointed out that aspect. The third point I want up is an aim for the space program, like a major focus, not just the singular focus for everything, but a major focus for most of their activities would be something to sort of set the goal for everything. But the fourth one is kind of the clinker, politicians' special interest. A lot of people for years now have been saying, oh, we can spend the money better elsewhere. For that, I could say we can take the whole world gross national product, spend it today, and solve the world's problems today. But the thing is, we'll probably have to do it all over again tomorrow. No matter how much money we'll spend on problems, there will always be more. So there is no way to solve all the world's problems like that easily. And all too often, we will have politicians and special interests wheedling away at the space program like this. Remember, the solid rocket boosters were not what NASA wanted. The politicians say, oh, can you do it for cheaper? And admittedly, NASA said yes, and they said the SRBs. They said, but we don't want them because they're not safe. And we got the Challenger for that as well. Admittedly, politicians are doing their job trying to cut things cheaper, but too often we have a lot of them lining their pockets in one way or another. You'll find some politicians trying to use this to make political hay,
all right,
unfortunately.
Mark. All right. Thanks for calling.
No problem.
Dr. Friedman, were you going to jump in there with something?
Yeah, I was going to pick up on this comment that you made and he made too, which is it took the tragedy of Challenger and this one also and other great debates. We always invoke the exploration theme. I so vividly remember Ronald Reagan going down to Texas and, in my opinion, saving the space program by congratulating the astronauts, not congratulating, but memorializing the astronauts for going further and faster and higher and being heroes and exploring the unknown. And, of course, they weren't doing that at all. They were carrying on a rather routine mission, carrying a communication satellite to orbit and teaching and doing a teacher in space activity, both very mundane activities. The result of that was, however, though, by invoking the exploration team, he did save the space program. That's the dichotomy. We got to get out of this position of constructing our program to do these ventures that aren't the basis of our reasons for being in space, and leave it only to the tragedies to remind us of why we're doing it. I think we need to construct a program for the reasons that we're doing it. And I hope the exploration team now comes back as the reminder why we have a human spaceflight program, indeed why we have a NASA at all.
1-800-989-8255. On the other hand, you'll hear astronauts who have been on the shuttle will say, you know, there are experiments up there that have to be like a laboratory on Earth. They have to be handled by people, have to be watched and cared for. Experiments done that way. And if you want to
very expensive.
Very expensive.
Very, very expensive to do it that way.
Mm-hmm. I think nevertheless, I mean, we have to understand that I think the human component is essential, not just for the exploration ethos that Lou Friedman was talking about and stirring the imagination, inspiring, but there's also tangible benefits that come out of this, and the science that we're doing is progressing human knowledge in many areas, and it also inspires people in the field of education, you know, not just in areas of human knowledge in terms of scientific investigation, and that requires a human component. You know, many of the experiments we have on shuttle and hopefully many of the scientific investigations will be carried forward on station in the future, assuming we can fix the political problems and also technical issues. We'll have, you know, tremendous benefits. So there is also that tangible side. It's not just an intangible, but there's also the tangible benefits that can come forward. And it's hard to quantify those. You know, it's unexpected. It's long term. You know, that's why I really firmly feel, as you know, also being part of the space colonization community, that a grand enterprise such as space colonization or space settlement can play a fundamental role in benefits for humanity in solving our basic problems back here on Earth as well. We have to understand that exploring space is not just about going to the moon or Mars, but it's also about solving our problems back here at home.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about space this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to Allison. Is it in Snohomish, Washington?
Sammamish, thank you.
Sammamish, I'm sorry.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, thank you for having me on. I think it's wonderful that we're having a debate about space policy, and I've enjoyed your panel, and the callers have called in with some good points. I feel as though, for me, the single most important point to stress is that the reason why we don't do more in space is because of the prohibitive cost of accessing space. The space transportation system that we have today, as it's been pointed out, is not the one that was originally intended, and that was mostly policy decisions to save money and research and development initially at the cost of operational expense now. And if you look at the budget that NASA put out last year for the Space Launch Initiative, it was downgraded to a research and development program, and we do not currently have a replacement shuttle system in active development. There are studies, But that needs to be, in my opinion, the single most important focus of what we do next with our space program. Is we need to get a fully reusable, truly reliable space transportation system.
To do what?
To do what we're doing now better and cheaper, and to do more, to do the things that we've talked about, to dream, to go into the stars, so that we can get more bang for our buck at the lower cost per launch, and that we can diversify. We can do manned, we can do unmanned. We can pretty much eliminate most of the risk if you have an incremental testability going into the system. I'm sure that Ms. Professor Friedman knows what I'm talking about.
We've got about a minute left, Dr. Friedman. Sum up what you were saying.
Can't have time to answer it on the air here, Allison. But do you think that we should keep the humans carrying the basic cargo vehicle up in this new reusable launch vehicle or new reusable next generation space shuttle? I think that's been the fundamental problem that we're stuck with right now. I think we need to give some thought to the idea of separating out the cargo carrying capacity, leave the humans in more of the ferrying capacity the way the Russians have done, you might be able to separate out these functions and get a more efficient goal.
So we could have we could have a small space plane that just takes the people back and forth and leave the unmanned flights for the cargo like the Russians are doing now.
That may work.
Yeah. All right, we've run out of time. This is just the beginning of the debate. I'm sure we will revisit this topic as we cover more of the future of space exploration. My guests are Louis Friedman, Executive Director of the Planetary Society, which is based in Pasadena, California, and Eligar Sadeh, Assistant Professor in the Space Studies Department of Odegaard School of Aerospace Sciences. That's at the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. He's also editor of the book Space Politics and Policy in Evolutionary Perspective, published by Kluwer. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Earlier, NPR science correspondent Richard Harris joined us. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Charles Berquist, Adrian McDonald, and senior producer Karen Vergath. And if you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 36th floor, New York, New York, 10020. And if you missed any of the links we talked about today, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You'll also find Science Friday's Kids Connection there. That's a free curricula that we put up for school teachers and classrooms to use based on our Science Friday programs there for your taking. You can also leave us email there, and any of the links, Space Society, whatever that we talked about on Science Friday, you can find them there. You can also find back editions of Science Friday and download them on your portable digital player coming from audible.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.